And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, you can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM, and you can check us out on the web at taylor-report.com. Incidentally, on September 2nd of this year, we spoke with Michael Mandel, who we're going to be talking about with our guests, and he gave us a really animated, typical Michael Mandel interview. It was full of information, and it is available on the website. Professor Harry Glasspeak is the Professor Emeritus Osgoode Hall Law School at York University. He's also the author of Wealth by Stealth. I like that title, Wealth by Stealth, Corporate Crime, Corporate Law, and the Perversion of Democracy. Our other guest is, of course, David Jacobs, who is a Toronto lawyer, was once a student of Michael Mandel, but also was part of that celebrated effort to have NATO charged with war crimes. There was a bootless errand. And, well, anyway, welcome to you both, Harry and David. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much.
Now, Michael Mandel, who we're speaking of today, he died at the age of 65. He was a guy who always struck me. He was very athletic. I don't know if he was an athlete, but he sure looked good. And he kept up a strong front and was fighting to the end. But I wonder if he could maybe David or Harry, either one. We probably ought to mention how did he, what was the cause of death?
Okay, well, I'll speak about it. I mean, I just start off to say I find it very hard to speak about just emotionally. Michael was a teacher of mine, a colleague of mine, but also a friend who I loved deeply. And it was very hard to see him go through since he was diagnosed. He'd been ill for a while, but he was diagnosed properly in January of this year with a very rare condition called amyloidosis, which attacked his heart. He went through a couple of series of treatments, but unfortunately the treatment didn't hold. And he was, when you were talking about how lively he was, I mean,
he was still making major contributions. He was writing, I think it was late August, he took on the desire of the U.S. to attack Syria, and he was right in there.
Right into the last couple of weeks. He was still writing letters to editors telling them why they were wrong and so on. Yes, all the way. And you're right, he was very athletic. He liked playing hockey and running about, all these things. So the disease was sort of one of these things that happens to people and should never happen.
People mentioned he was 65, and everybody said, no, he was younger than that. But just because he was so vigorous and a very brilliant fellow. But, Harry, I wonder if you could tell us. I know you spoke at the memorial for Michael. And we'd be very interested in knowing what was the gist of your remarks there?
Well, basically, it was truly one of these things. I mean, I'm an academic, right, so I speak spoke for a living. But this wasn't for a living. It was really sort of from the heart. And what it is, Michael was an amazing man. I mean, we all in academic life pretend that we're interested in finding truth and getting everything right and being honest. But Michael actually lived that life. And that's what the gist of the remarks were, how sincere he was about everything he did. And he did a lot of things. I mean, in many ways, he was a Renaissance man. But in law, he saw law as a form of politics, and he saw law as a way of maintaining a status quo, which he did not like at all. So he looked for truth about that, and he found ways of representing and thinking about the vulnerable and the oppressed. And he went through lots and lots of difficulties doing that. But in all his work, and this is what I try to stress, in all his work, he showed amazing, almost indomitable courage, regardless of the jeers and you might get as an academic by breaching the conventional wisdom. He would always stand up for what he thought was right, and he nearly always was right, by the way. He was amazingly meticulous in his work as well. So I try to stress that. He was like that in the rest of his life. He liked traditions. He liked the Yiddish tradition. He liked the Jewish traditions, and he lived by them. He loved music, and he lived by that. So all of these things were sincerely held, and he lived them, and that's really what I spoke about.
The thing about, I noticed that he, This you mentioned he's courageous. He took on to take on NATO at a time when NATO is in a mood to attack.
And they have bombs.
And bombs were falling, as they say. Mm. And yet he put together a very substantial brief, in the sense that he wasn't just giving us, you know, a political speech. He made a case, and he did it quickly. Yeah. I was struck by how quick and efficiently he put together thorough arguments for people who really needed them, actually. You know, you have anti-war movements, but Michael could give you chapter and verse.
Well, he had two capacities. One, he had a very, very high degree of intelligence. And the other was he worked like a dog. And so he was very careful, so he got all these things done quickly. And as you said, he did manage to prepare briefs very quickly and very, very precise. He was very clear in his thinking. He cut through Kant like nobody else. I worked with him, and I wrote with him, and I always found that to be true. He was much quicker than I was. He was much more insightful. He was much more forceful than I was. And David had him as a teacher, and I guess he was like that in the classroom. I luckily did not have to listen to him.
Well, actually, that's probably a good place to go. Mm-hmm. David, you were both a student and also on some matters a colleague. You were part of the effort with NATO, but tell us about what it was like to be a student.
Well, I should roll back. My wife, Bryna, reminds me of how I met Harry and Michael. I thought after all the politics of the 60s and the early 70s, and I got to law school in the mid-70s, I suppose it was, that it was going to be a bit of a quieter time. But my first day in law school, a colleague of Harry's and Michael's, Reuben Hansen, stood up in the first class on the first day and said in a very precise English accent, I believe there's going to be a strike of the support staff. If there is, you will not find me here. You'll find me on the picket line. And lo and behold, there was a strike. The Osgoode Law faculty were actually more supportive of the strike than anyone else up at York. And I met Harry and Michael and Reuben on the picket line. And we became friends and colleagues. Harry taught me evidence and labor.
By the way,
law.
That tells me that the law school itself is rather exceptional. I think most law schools wouldn't be on.
I think that's true. They actually shut down the law schools, but my best recollection, Harry will remember better. So Michael taught me criminal law, and I remember that we had to read Foucault on crime and punishment, and he was an absolutely wonderful teacher. We had a seminar. He was discursive. He was engaged. He listened, and he talked, and he persuaded. And that's how I found him ever since. He's passionate, absolutely passionate in his views, and a passionate listener and speaker as well. He absorbed information tremendously. And as you were saying about, he was persuasive. I mean, he persuaded me to accompany him to The Hague and to put my name to, and I think Harry's name was, I'm sure Harry's name was on it as well, to a very long 41-page indictment of Clinton and Tony Blair and Chrétien, et cetera, for war crimes committed in the former Yugoslavia. And it's an absolutely indelible moment in my life. It is a high point. And if I can tell just one story about it.
Tell as many as you like. By the way, I do. I remember that you met. I think that what you did has impact. You know, there's a tendency to think, well, it's as I call it, a bootless errand. That was careless of me. My guess is that action actually reverberated. That people, you might have even contributed to the alienation of Carla Del Ponte, then prosecutor, from the whole exercise herself. She later abandoned that group of people now running those ad hoc tribunals.
I think that's right. We had the most fascinating and at the time, frustrating meeting with Michael had, as Harry just told you, put together this wonderful brief. I mean, with photographs and footnotes and hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, which accompanied this 41-page indictment, showing the terrible war crimes that NATO was committing, the bombing of civilian hospitals, of radio stations, and so on, and just outlining word by word what war crimes they were and what sections of Geneva Conventions were breached. So we met with Carla Del Ponte, who was the chief prosecutor, and she was flanked by two other lawyers, neither of whom we know. One happened to be Canadian from the military, from Canadian military, and the other happened to be Scottish, a Scottish prosecutor.
Can I ask you, by the way, didn't we – I worked on some of these matters, of course, under working with Charles Roach.
Right, sure.
But didn't we find a pattern of people who were military people who were – lawyers who both at the tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, but also the one in Yugoslavia.
Absolutely.
They didn't come from typical law firms. They came out of the U.S. military
Michael, and Canadian. Michael and I, they're trying to indict the leadership of NATO, and Carlo Del Ponte is flanked by two NATO lawyers from NATO countries, basically. One from actually from NATO military.
And I remember, you were that close to waterboarding.
Yeah, that's right. At one point, Michael's saying, look, it's an illegal aggression. There's no legal basis for the attack on Yugoslavia. And they were sort of shrugging about that. And he looked at them, I remember at one point, which I thought was a high point, he said to them, do you mean if what the United States and Britain and NATO wants to do is overthrow the legitimate government of Yugoslavia and replace it with a government friendly to them, you would only prosecute if they, even if they fought house to house to do it, if they killed too many civilians in the process? And the Canadian lawyer looked at him and said, bingo. That, you know. And that was basically the end of it. I mean, it was immensely frustrating. We went away and tried to enjoy ourselves in Holland. I remember he took me to a very sad symphony after that.
Yeah. To a sad symphony?
Yes. Mahler on the death of his children.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, but now, I guess you had mixed feelings. But I would argue that it definitely had impact. For one thing, you provided a personal nightmare to Carlo Del Ponte. She did, after all, meet you in the flesh. She had to confront these arguments and Michael. And my guess is that ever after, she remembered that meeting.
Well, she has written a – sorry, Harry.
Go ahead.
She has written a book where she's described that she was actually very disturbed by the evidence of war crimes. So
did she say that?
She did, yes.
No, it has left a deeper impact as well, I think, because now it's quite common for people to talk about war crimes and war criminals and trying to talk about leaders of countries which have invaded and bombed and done all these things as people who are just beyond the pale. And that's a new thing, I think, in political discourse. We haven't had that before. Maybe the crimes are larger than they've ever been. I'm not sure of that. But certainly the talk about those people being criminals, and I think that can be attributed to work like David and Michael did, and Michael did in his book on how the Americans get away with murder. You got to remember, as I said, he had courage beyond belief, and somewhere early out in 2002, maybe, I remember he referred at some meeting to the White House criminal thugs, right, and the Bush family. And these things last. I mean, they leave an impression. You remember when Mulroney was called a liar by some woman. That lasted. I mean, there are things that people say which are visceral, but which are supportable, which have an impact. And I think much of Michael's work was of that kind.
Yeah. We're speaking to Professor Harry Glasspiegel and to David Jacobs, and of course we're remembering and commenting on the work of Michael Mandel. And incidentally, I mean, to put together such a solid book as he did, and then to title it "How America Gets Away with Murder," I mean, that's getting to the point, you know. And if you'd, I wonder what his thinking was there. You point out that you might say his orientation was radical, but in my mind, if you don't say it clearly, what it is you're trying to address, but you mince words, your opponent will take you up on the mincing part and help you mince, and before you know it, you've lost your point. But
you're absolutely right, and Michael was aware of that.
It was murder, and they got away with it.
Yes, and he was, and what, the thing about that book and his other major work, which was on the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, was that he was right. In legal terms, he was very, very careful. So when he said it was murder, he made the case. So he could call it murder, and it attracted attention, but you couldn't not then throw it out. You could not then say it's not right. And that was his gift. That was his gift to all of us, I think.
Yes. By the way, I have a book in front of me that I think he must have admired, by Edward Herman and David Peterson, titled "The Politics of Genocide." And I noticed that they cited Michael in several instances in that book, again, because his work stood up so well. And of course, when he did this, it heartened people who felt that they were voiceless. I recall the bombing of Serbia Certainly there were people from former Yugoslavia who couldn't believe it and who felt that they couldn't get any attention, and Michael became their voice. And he stood, and you and David, you and others, I think it was it David Orton and others?
Orchard, yeah, David
Orchard. Orchard.
Thistle Franklin.
Organized meetings and brought to the city, by the way, some rather brilliant people. I recall a former prosecutor from Nuremberg.
Correct. Walter Rockler. Walter Rockler, he's now deceased, unfortunately. He is an exceptionally brilliant man. And I think Michael did actually love the people he was fighting on behalf of and struggling with. Like Harry said, he did actually love oppressed people. I know they were eternally loved. He was absolutely adored. And I think still held in great regard by the Serbian community, by the Palestinian community.
Been coming in to the site. They're still receiving comments of people from around the world talking about. I know it's from Serbia and from the Palestinian community here. Khaled Muammar, for example, I saw his comments. By the way, I should bring in Phil here. Yes. Phil Conlon knew Michael on another level.
Michael, these rigorous and direct qualities that have been described, Michael brought to his analysis of the music scene and of opera. And Michael knew an encyclopedic amount about the proper way to sing opera, right? And he didn't like a particular famous singer, and he once told me in the course of what I would say, I wouldn't say it was an hour-long rant, it was an hour-long analysis about why this particular tenor, who was the biggest in the world, was...
Main names.
Pavarotti.
It wasn't Elvis.
Was the debasement of the coin. I'll never forget Michael said he has debased the coin, the coinage of proper Italian singing. And along with the great...
He had moments when he was a proper Italian.
Political, physical crimes at Michael, that cultural crimes are something that were very much within Michael's purview. And he didn't let you get away with it, right? And if Pavarotti pulled a cheap stunt on stage, Michael told you about it, and he condemned it. And it says,
wow.
And you know. By the way, the classical music world, like a lot of the rest of the culture world, has a lot of people in it who don't get paid very well and make a very tenuous living. And then they have one or two superstars who pull in tens of millions of dollars a year, and that's not enough for them, right? And that was Pavarotti, right? And Michael hated that. You know, and he could tell you. He says, "Listen, this is how much they're paying this guy. This is what he does wrong." And you know, there's this wonderful little tenor, and he would name some small town in Italy and say, "This guy is, and he can do it better than Pavarotti." And I'll tell you why. And he would tell you why.
You know, by the way, you have a program each Tuesday, 12
Tuesday
o'clock,
Classical Underground,
and,
yes.
And you had Michael's son there.
Yes.
And what I'm just as I'm listening, I'm just so pained that you didn't have an opportunity to bring Michael to do that kind of commentary.
No, I would have loved it.
I mean,
that.
We really lost something.
We certainly did.
Shaw was a music critic, right, and we really appreciate Shaw's writing on music.
Absolutely, and I would have loved to have put Michael on to tell people why, you know, don't think that Luciano Pavarotti is what represents the best of classical music. Well, I mean, that would have been a great program that we'll never get to do.
Classical music could use some good arguments. Yeah. It needs some, right?
To air
the place out.
And you're right that when you mentioned George Bernard Shaw, he was very good at it, and you know, there haven't been an awful lot since. I mean, there's a lot of snobs who, you know, turn up their noses and stuff, but that wasn't Michael. I mean, he was talking from the perspective of somebody who truly loved the music, especially loved Giuseppe.
But he also brought politics into that music.
Absolutely.
Well, give us an idea of what he appreciated it had of a political flavor.
Well, I mean, he certainly loved Verdi's setting of Otello, which, I mean, many of us consider the apotheosis of Italian opera. And he understood very well, I mean, Verdi's role. Verdi, of course, was a revolutionary. Verdi was a member of the first parliament of the Kingdom of Italy after the country was united, and all of Verdi's work was informed by his passion for justice in the world and his understanding that there are human casualties and human tragedies and human suffering happens in the course of struggling for justice. Michael understood that, and we had a lot of good discussions about Rigoletto, for instance, which was a revolutionary work because it made a hero out of a marginal employee of the royal court, right? Mm-hmm. hadn't been done before, right?
It's the kind of thing that Michael would like to do.
That's right.
And you would have liked to play.
Yeah. well, of course. And of course, he would have liked to say, I will always admire Michael for, in the middle of his career, going off to Bologna for a year to study singing. I thought this was a man who really...
That is impressive.
If there was a Renaissance man, this was it.
Of course, the voice of Phil Connor. By the way, Phil, did you say you had an announcement you want to make tomorrow?
November 11th is coming up, and you know the Canadians like to get very solemn and mournful and walk around and say, let's do it all over again.
Well, some do. So what are you doing tomorrow?
Yeah, so what we're doing over the next 2 weeks is we're going to play the music of a lot of composers who were affected very badly by World War I and poets, some of whom were killed in the war, some of whom saw their friends die, and some of whom wrote music and poetry in protest against the futility of that war. Hmm. And next week we will conclude that with the Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. Yeah.
Good. All right. Well, you're listening to Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And, of course, it's taylor-report.com for programs such as this that are already up and available. Something about him that hasn't gotten the attention that I hope it gets is that he was working on a book about his father.
Yes, indeed.
And is that going to be, do we know about it?
Well, I'm not, he did finish the manuscript. It needs editing and presumably finding a publisher. I hope this will be taken into hand. And it started off basically about a book about his father, who was quite a well-known musician here. He had the Yiddish Hour on the CBC in the early 40s, and he was well-known, as Michael would have described him, was truly a rock star of the day. And Michael was very interested. His father died when he was very young, and he was very interested in his life. And he started working about his father, looking into his father's life. And then what he discovered, and it was very, very typical of Michael, that he found that the really interesting aspect of it was the context, and the context, the social context, and the traditional context, and that was the Jewish community of that time in and around Toronto. So he did a considerable amount of work on the newspapers and archives of that period, and that's what he's just finished. And he just finished that just before he became quite ill and had to give up. But it's there, and I hope it will be published.
I heard that he began to study Yiddish.
Was it his intention
to write in Yiddish?
No, I think it was part of his. He wanted to be able to read all this and to understand it. But also, he had a love for these cultural aspects of being Jewish. And Yiddish is an old tradition from where he came from or his family came from in Europe. And he became conversable when he sang. He sang a lot of he sang around town. He became sort of the Yiddish voice to go to as a singer in town. That was his completion of his musical life, rather than being a Pavarotti. So he became really deeply interested in the cultural and linguistic aspect. There's a movement to save Yiddish as a language.
By the way, were some of those programs, any of them preserved? Do you know?
I'm sorry?
His father's programs, were there any of them preserved?
Yes, he's got quite a... He's got recordings of his father of singing, and I've actually got a record of it, to which I listen fairly frequently.
Wow. David, do you know about this project?
Yeah, not much beyond what Harry was doing, other than Michael used to take me through these newspapers, Yiddish newspapers, written in Hebrew script, which he had become quite fluent in, and was showing me all sorts of fascinating bits and pieces of the, as Harry said, the politics and of the time, not just about his father. So it's quite a fascinating archive of what was going on in Toronto in the 1930s, 1940s, with the Jewish community. You can recreate through that, and I'm very interested to read his book, all of the different political strains in the Jewish community,
By the way, when they did those programs, those things were all done. If they brought in musicians, it was all done live.
Right? Oh, yes, I believe so.
They didn't have the luxury of pre-recording or redoing it. You had to go out there and do it.
Bit like this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh! I dropped my pen. Yeah, it's true. Mm. Incidentally, I think at the end of the day, that might make for better programming. I mean, it
certainly more human. I think.
Yeah, the over editing has led to a lot of. Taking some of the energy out of programs. That's been argued. I know even around this studio people have talked about it. It's preferable to be as live and direct as you can. You're listening to Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. We are speaking to Professor Harry Glasbeck, Professor Emeritus, Osgoode Hall Law School, and with David Jacobs, a Toronto lawyer who also was part of the effort to stop NATO. And though that little project didn't succeed, it certainly left a dent in the operation. And I wonder, I get the impression. Let's talk about a major idea that certainly Michael Mandel addressed and with real passion, and that was this new concept of responsibility to protect. By the way, I always find it a little oily. Sometimes it changes the words duty to protect or right to protect. But basically, it has been used recently by NATO powers in Libya, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And there's a UN aura has been added to it, and Michael was vigorous in fighting that. And his last big battle, in terms of being seen in print, was this article he wrote in response to, I think it was Axworthy and Rock.
Axworthy and Rock.
Rock, the un-rock star. And the two of them had written this kind of strange argument that the United States should not be deterred from attacking Syria simply by a UN Security Council refusal to endorse it, that they should go ahead and do it anyway. And Michael was incensed, and he wrote a brilliant article. I recommend, by the way, it was Common Dreams, isn't it?
Yes, it was.
CommonDreams.com. You can find the article. But what about that idea? And Harry, speaking to Harry Glasbeck, what did you make of that argument?
Well, I, as usual, I was led by Michael on this. The argument, as he saw it, and I think rightly so, was a way to get around what had been established as what going to be the new ground rules after the Second World War about what was the right of any one nation state to use its power to intervene with any other sovereign state. And the ground rules were very simple because of the great cataclysm of the Second World War, that only imminent danger to your own state was a reason to take up arms against anyone else. And there are a whole series of provisions and protocols, which Michael examined at length in all of his works, actually, and in all of his works in there. The R2P, whatever it stands for, and however cute it sounds, I think the very fact that you use an expression like R2P is indicative of its fragile intellectual credibility, because it's sort of like a branding exercise, right? You're selling soap with a slogan.
And flashing it like a badge.
Badge, yes.
I'm here in R2P.
And I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for you. and that's why. And that is hopeless. And that's what Michael saw, and I think quite rightly saw, as a way of getting around fundamental rules and allowing people with military power, which of course in most cases in our parts of the world means the U.S., to use their raw power without the restraints of law. And as a person who's interested in international criminal law, as he was, this was a grave, grave offense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's written, actually, this year while he was gravely ill, he wrote a series of pieces. He wrote a piece, I think earlier this year, it was published in some compendium about responsibility to protect, where he attacks it on two bases. I mean, the first basis, he says, look, there's only you can't go to war legitimately, except in self-defense, without the approval and resolution of the UN Security Council. And then he goes on to say, but there is this now exception, which was used once, I guess, in Libya, to allow the UN Security Council to approve war on this responsibility to protect basis. And he says, but if you unpack that,
but
it's
not
also
war, but
a bad
to
thing.
Protect civilians, right?
Well, theoretically, to protect civilians.
My, you know, it was such a dirty game they played where they said they wanted to. What was the word? They wanted a no-fly zone, and they were only going to enforce a no-fly zone. And then all of a sudden, relatives of the leader of the country are being murdered by bombs, and very specific civilian targets are being blown to bits, and they keep saying, this is a no-fly zone, even though the Libyan Air Force was not flying. Well, so they didn't have a problem.
I don't intend to read much, but in Michael's book, I mean, he anticipated all of this.
Feel free to read anything from Michael Mandel.
Okay, there you go.
This is a tribute to Michael.
Yeah, and How America Gets Away with Murder, he gets right to the heart of the problem with the whole idea of responsibility to protect, or the idea that you're going in to protect civilians, which is, who can believe you? I mean, if you're one of the big states saying, well, now we're going to attack this other state for their own good. And he quotes here Hitler. And Hitler says, before invading Poland, about the mistreatment of people in Poland, says their provocations against women and children, they're maltreated, in some cases killed. I've ever resolved to speak to Poland in the same language the Polanders for months past used towards us. And he's saying, well, Hitler's saying, because of the horrible
he's
treatment.
He's going to go and protect people.
He's going to go and protect women and children of Poland.
Wasn't
the
tin drum about this, that situation, that community?
Absolutely.
The Danzig community.
Absolutely. And then Michael goes one step further, of course, and in a meticulously researched articles, and there's an interview that he did for something called New Left Press. I think it was a New Left Project. I think it's a monthly review type of thing. In April of this year, where he says, and I'm going to quote this, and this I guess goes back to our speaking about how bluntly and courageously Michael spoke. He said, the fact that the U.S. and the U.K. and their accomplices in NATO were never sanctioned for their supreme international criminality in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Iraq, where hundreds of thousands of civilians were in effect murdered, illegally killed, is not promising. Nor is the fact that all of the institutions set up to prosecute illegal behavior, the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals, as well as the International Criminal Court, have turned out to be the lapdogs of the West.
Uh-huh.
And he's gone further. I've read in other places where he says that they were actually set up to justify these illegal wars rather than anything else.
Well, of course, I was in the courtroom when Luis Arbour opened with a dramatic speech about what the tribunal was going to accomplish. And she said, unlike Nuremberg, this is not going to be victor's justice. So she committed, in my view, two crimes. She misrepresented what happened in Nuremberg. But then she proceeded to preside over a prosecution that never indicted or charged anyone from the winning side.
Yes.
I mean, which should have been the end of it, at least in terms of respect. You know, I think, by the way, this is one of the things that made Michael rather passionate about this. There's a disappointment that legal minds don't see point out obvious things, right?
Well, yes, he would have said that, but I think he would also go on to say something else, which is even more characteristic of his thinking, is that I once quoted, fairly recently I wrote a piece in which I quoted him, in which he said that if you can speak about something without referring to that thing, then you have the mind of a lawyer.
And sorry, could you repeat that? If you have to do what?
If you can speak about something without referring to that thing, then you have a mind of a lawyer. And what he meant was that if you don't refer to it in context, if you don't see it in its social context, then merely mentioning something is sort of lip service to a whole series of conventional views that are not worth preserving. And that's what he saw in all these things when he sees that way. I mean, for instance, we're talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on, and Kosovo. He had the same view in Palestine, right? I mean, he had strong feelings as a Jewish man. All of his traditions are about a Jewish man. But he never shied away from saying that Israel was murdering people because it was the aggressor in the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. The aggressor is to be held responsible. And that was clearly his view. That's the view on R2P that he has. He had the same view on judges on the Supreme Court of Canada when they talked about liberal rights in Canada. He says their purpose is not that at all. They speak about that. They speak freedom of belief, freedom of association, freedom of speech. He said they say all of these things. But what they mean is that they're going to protect the wealthy, and they're interested in $1, one vote, $1, one vote, not one person, one vote. So it was always the underneath, the actual reality that perturbed him, that moved him, that made him write, that made him talk. And he never left that alone.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Professor Harry Glasspiegel and, of course, to David Jacobs, and Phil Conlon is here as well, and Conlon knows about his passion for music. But incidentally, Phil, wasn't it Bandera Rosa that he wanted played somewhere?
Yes, and we opened the program last week with Bandera Rosa.
wonderful.
in commemoration of Michael.
Mm. It did. Now, I noticed that when he took on this R2P thing with Mr. Rock and the other, that he found them, they were on his ground. They didn't realize, because they tried a phrase, the Kosovo precedent. And he said, well, you know, like a good lawyer who's actually in charge of his brief, you don't really know what you're talking about when you're talking about Kosovo. And but it is really a worrying thing that they would casually try to sneak that past as though, oh yes, well, the Kosovo thing shows that we have to do this. Dave, can you talk a little bit about what was wrong with that Kosovo?
What was wrong with it? The attack on Yugoslavia was, I think I'm looking at the title of an article by Michael, "Say What You Want, But This War Is Illegal." And actually, he's talking about Afghanistan there, but it goes back to his point. Look, at the end of World War II, I think Michael, maybe I haven't read it, but I think Michael was telling me about writing an article where he was going to use some acronyms, which was, UNC versus R2P, which is the UN Charter versus Responsibility to Protect. The UN Charter starts off by saying that it's there to end the scourge of war. And Michael never tired of repeating that part of it. He also never tired of repeating what the Nuremberg Tribunal said, which was that the starting of a war of aggression or a war contrary to international treaties is a supreme war crime within which the evil of all the other war crimes is contained.
Yes.
And the great tragedy of...
I remember the Nuremberg prosecutor said...
Jackson.
That was his...
It was Jackson, right.
Yeah.
Robert Jackson. So Michael never tired of repeating that, and I think he's almost in the conclusion of many of his articles about this. Just to bring it home to you, what the UN Charter was to do was to say, look, you can't go to war. You can only go to war for two reasons. One, in self-defense, and that is when troops from a foreign nation are virtually pouring over your borders or just about to. Or with the approval of the UN Security Council in a situation where there's a threat to international peace and security. So there is and was no third version of this, and Michael goes to painstaking research, but the International Court of Justice in The Hague, not the International Criminal Court, this is an older court, they're called the World Court, had a case called Nicaragua.
People have almost forgotten about the existence of that court.
Nicaragua in the United States. And the U.S. was doing all sorts of violent actions against the Sandinista government of Nicaragua, which took them to the World Court. And the justification for the United States was humanitarian justification. They were helping the Contras and all these rather nasty terrorists in there, but they were doing it for a good reason, which is they were helping the poor embattled people in Nicaragua. And the World Court, the International Court of Justice, said unequivocally, there is no such thing. There's no such thing as humanitarian intervention. We condemn it. And the General Assembly of the United Nations repeated that and repeated it. But now you have acts where the...
So they found themselves in another court.
That is exactly right. They did find themselves in another court.
Founded themselves in another court.
And
there was a warning shot to that effect, you know, because when the decision came down, the Nicaraguan case, against the United States said that it would ignore it because it was in international law meant nothing. And that day, the decision was handed down, was declared by Reagan to be Law Day.
forevermore.
There's a rather I should mention this. I mean, there's a disturbing piece by Una Paris in the Globe today where she's trying to persuade African countries not to bow out to the International Criminal Court. And she says, you know, it's kind of I'm maybe being unjust to her argument, it's kind of a start. And it's good that while the U.S. sort of bowed out of it, the U.S. is now playing a bigger role in it. Which is
the ICC.
The ICC.
It's playing a bigger role. It hasn't joined.
No, it hasn't joined. No, it's helping them prosecute people it doesn't
like.
It's
the uncle of the... I don't know the answer to this. Did Michael pronounce himself on the ICC?
He had the same view of the ICC.
I wish Michael had been a judge, by the way. See, this is the time I want to be able to say, Judge Michael Mandel said. But what was his take on the ICC?
International
Criminal Court.
A lapdog of the West.
Oh, it was the ICC. I thought it was the ad hocs. He's speaking specifically.
Of all of them, yes. Existed to justify aggressive war.
Yeah. By the way, Michael Mandel's book, How America Gets Away with Murder, Illegal Wars, Collateral Damage, and Crimes Against Humanity, that's published by Pluto Press, and that was in 2004. He had another book, very important to Canadians, Charter of Rights, the legalization of politics in Canada, and that's 1994. Maybe in a minute here, I ask you quickly if you could, Dave, summarize what is his Charter of Rights book?
Well, I think this I've got to flip to Harry because he gives special thanks to Harry about that book, and I know Harry and he, I think it's fair to say, worked on the idea.
Well, yes, I'd like to take that much credit. He and I did an article together when the charter was first being pursued by the Trudeau government, which was called The Legalization of Politics, and that became his book, which is a much larger and much more extended work, of course, and been a very influential one.
By the way, I like the phrase, legalization of politics really focuses the mind.
Yes, and that was the idea. The idea was simply that, and which Michael ran, I think, quite brilliantly, the idea was that what we've done is we've taken away whatever small elements of democracy we have, and we've entrusted elites with decision-making about the most important policy issues in our time. And he resented that, and he goes to great and considerable effort to show how often the judiciary betrays such Canadian values as we can identify, and that's what the legalization of politics is all about.
Yeah, if I have a second just to mention that, I mean, one of the other things, he, which is, I think, quite brilliant in the book, he says that the charter have all these sort of nice phrases about freedom of speech, freedom of association, but what it really did, and what it did very specifically, is take away the rights that Quebec had since Confederation to control of language, and that's what I think Mike thought was core to the charter, yeah. And the rest was dressing.
Well, listen, that's terrific. Those two books are available: How America Gets Away with Murder, Charter of Rights, and the Legalization of Politics in Canada. I want to thank Professor Harry Glasspiegel, Professor Emeritus Osgoode Hall Law School, York University, and David Jacobs, a Toronto lawyer and colleague, and both dear friends of Michael Mandel, and of course Phil Conlon. I'm really glad we could do this tribute to Michael, and what I like about this is there's so much in Michael back to and focus on, and so thank you all very, very much. This is Phil Taylor for The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll see you next week.